dead people don't have any data protection rights. The GDPR, which governs data privacy in Europe, for instance, explicitly leaves out deceased individuals. That means that if we would have a situation where a big tech platform that may host hundreds of millions of dead profiles and sometimes an entire lifetime of data on those profiles, or say it would be one of these ancestry genealogy sites that holds the DNA of tens of millions of people, many of whom are going to be dead. Let's say one of these companies go bust. What's going to happen to the data? Well, it's going to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. Now, we living users have normally some means of protecting ourselves, but for these potentially hundreds of millions of dead people, they're just going to be auctioned off to whomever is the highest bidder.
Hi, everybody. This is Arlo Gilbert, co-founder and CEO of Osano, a leading data privacy management platform. And you are listening to the Privacy Insider Podcast. This show explores the past, present, and future of data privacy for privacy and business leaders alike, as well as anyone who wants to keep privacy top of mind. Welcome to the Privacy Insider Podcast. My name is Arlo Gilbert. I'm the founder at Osano, a leading data privacy startup. But today, I'm your host on the Privacy Insider. We're joined today by one of the sharpest minds in digital culture and ethics, Professor Carl Ullman from Uppsala University in Sweden. Carl's breakthrough book, The Afterlife of Data, was named one of the top books of 2024 by Nature, The Guardian, and The Economist. It challenges everything we thought we knew about what happens to our data and our digital selves after we're gone. In his work, Carl dives into the hauntingly fascinating reality where your online footprint might actually outlive you, and AI can already talk with the digital dead. Today, we're peeling back the layers of his research, his journey from Oxford to global thought leader, and even the deep philosophical underpinnings of his forthcoming book, Gods of Data, a provocative, atheist-inflected critique of AI. This episode goes from the sociology of death to the soul of your machine. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, now, Carl, you have some really interesting views, and I'm super excited to talk about your journey into AI and data. But before we dive into this entire journey, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you end up in political science and how that political science somehow becomes centered around data and AI. Maybe a little bit of background about yourself would be helpful.
Sure. Yeah. It's one of these kind of funny stories. I actually, I applied to political science when I started university. It was my first hand choice and I got rejected. So I had to go with my second hand choice, which was sociology. So I studied sociology and comparative literature as a double major for my undergraduates. And I'm just a generally pretentious person. So I knew that I wanted to write about like the big revolution of our time. I wanted to write about the internet, digital technologies in some way. So I wrote both of my bachelor thesis on digital technologies and social media. And around that time, I think it was towards the end of my first year, I went to visit two friends of mine who were doing their undergraduate degrees at the University of Oxford. And I just had the most amazing 5 days when I visited. You know, it was sunny every day. It was in the beginning of summer. We just hung out in parks and had ports and, stayed up late in these beautiful gardens. Which is like a completely false impression of Oxford. It always rains. It's always cold. But for those 5 days, it was just absolutely amazing. And as I said, I had a lovely time, but I kept thinking like, hang on a minute, like these people are not so much smarter than I am. There should be a place for me here. And then I found out that there was something called the Oxford Internet Institute. And I was like, the Internet Institute? But that's what I study. That's what I do. So I applied for their master's degree and was admitted. And there I met a philosopher called Luciano Floridi, who's the father of the philosophy and ethics of information. And I did my PhD in his lab as well. When people ask me about my discipline, my response is often that I'm a sociologist who was brought up by analytical philosophers in Oxford. But when I was done, I knew I wanted to leave the UK. I knew I wanted to go back to Sweden. And there was this position that opened up in AI and political communication at the political science department. The first place I applied to when I applied to my undergraduate. And so I got this position, and that's where I'm still at. So I guess I'm a kind of like a rogue political science, political scientist now.
That's amazing. Now, I have to ask, because the way you talk about it is almost though as like at birth, you came out interested in research. I mean, what gets somebody interested in these kind of topics before you end up in the academic system as, you know, as a graduate or a master's or even at the college level? Was there something that inspired you or something that kind of drove you in that general direction?
It's a boring answer, really. I most researchers, like, they have such inspiring stories of how, like, I'm such an unlikely person to become a researcher. Like, I never thought, but then I had this wonderful professor or this wonderful teacher. That source of inspiration would be, like, everyone in my family. Like, everyone in my family is an academic. It's kind of like, what do you do? I was, like, 10 when I learned that there are other jobs. That being a professor, jokes aside, like I'm from a very academic family. That being said, there was never any pressure whatsoever to pursue academic studies of any kind. My dad, who's a professor of education, never once in my life asked me if I had any homework to do. He never asked me, like, about my grades. I know that once he asked, like, have you, like, do you get grades in school? And I was like,
do you
yeah,
get grades?
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, yeah, I do. He's like, oh, are they any good? And I was like, yeah, they're very good. And he's like, oh, nice. And that's like the one talk that we ever had about academic performance. So the first couple of years after finishing high school, I think I spent 3 years just exploring. I did some traveling. I worked some like stray jobs. And in a US context, I was supposed that would be referred to as sabbaticals or like gap years. In a Swedish context, it's quite common. But I think I was like 23 when I decided that I should go to university. And even then, I wasn't, as I said, I wanted to do something with the internet. Like, this was the early-ish or early to mid-2010s when everybody was so hyped up about, like, startup culture and technologies. I picture that I would do something like that, but I always had this kind of academic, I felt very, like, home, but at home amongst academics. I think that's what eventually drew me to the university. And once I got there, I got completely stuck.
Well, I can completely empathize with you. And although we didn't talk about this, I also come from an entire family of academics. So I identify closely with kind of understanding that that's the only job in the world and that everybody gets tenure and then they get to work on whatever's interesting to them with very little oversight. It certainly is an exciting path if you can manage to get there.
I remember the one time when I was a kid, and this was in high school, the only time that, like, I sort of suspected that there was an expectation that I would eventually become a professor was I read an essay to my dad that I had written in my Swedish class. And my dad's response was like, that's interesting. I think that maybe you will write your doctoral dissertation about the Swedish language.
Cute. That's right. Some people have parents with expectations that they're going to become a lawyer or a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, if you grow up in an academic family, they think about what your doctoral thesis will be about.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, so speaking of doctoral theses, because you developed a passion for AI and for data, political science, the intersection of the internet, and then you had this kind of, I don't know, kind of a prescient set of views that led to a book that is quite incredible, The Afterlife of Data. And I think that our audience would benefit from reading it, but perhaps you can give us a quick overview of the high level, the topics that you discuss in there.
So the elevator pitch would be that everything that you leave behind on the internet, and I'm not just talking about the data that you consciously upload there, you know, your Instagram photos or your Facebook posts, but like virtually every time you open your phone, every time you just take a step, your iPhone will record that and send it to the Apple Health app server. So literally everything that you do on your devices, and when I say devices, I'm not just meaning your phone and your laptop, but every connected device. Most cars are connected nowadays, your fridge, your oven, whatever. These gadgets leave traces behind, right? And those traces are still going to be around when you die. Now, somebody's going to be faced with the question, what do I do with all these digital footprints? And that's a practically challenging question. Where are these data located? Who owns them? How do you gain access to them? And so on. But it's also a morally challenging question of what should I do with my loved one's data? Let's say that one of my parents passes away or my grandparents. Okay, what should I do with the data? Maybe my kids would want to see their Instagram profiles in the future or see their Facebook posts or whatever kind of data it is. Now, I'm asking that kind of moral questions, but not about one person's data, but about an entire generation of internet users. So in the next 3 decades alone, about 2.5 billion people are going to die and leave huge heaps of data behind on the web. Now, my book is asking, from a kind of sociological and political point of view, what are we as a society going to do with these data? What are the political and sociological and economic implications of this question of what do we do with the digital dead? And that's what the book is about.
Yeah, I mean, and just hearing you talk about it, I feel emotion because it's about death, right? And, you know, I think that people in Europe have a little bit more of a reality about the fact that life comes to an end. Whereas, you know, in America, we have a little bit of a cowboy culture. I'm never going to die. I'm not going to think about it. So what is the right answer? I mean, do we come to a conclusion in your book about how we should be thinking about this data? Because I can think of a million things I don't want my kids to know, right? That Reddit post that maybe I got in and I was in a bad mood and I was kind of snarky and I, you know, posted some kind of, you know, I know better than you reply. Should that belong to my family or should it disappear when I die? Do you formulate any conclusions about the right philosophical approach?
First, let me just say that I'm really glad that you say that it sort of resonates on an emotional level, because that's something that was very important to me in writing the book and generally in my research, in drawing that connection between the individual psychological and emotional experience, you know, something that everyone can relate to. Whenever I bring this topic up, they're like, oh, this happened to my friend. Like, I see my friend popping up on social media every birthday and so on. And they have a sort of emotional connection to that. And to connect that experience with these global power struggles over who owns the past and, you know, what are these major long-term sociological implications, that's really a goal of mine. But to get back to your question of is there like a right answer, there are a couple of things to say on this and on various levels. There are some things that are obviously bad that we want, like that everyone would want to avoid. So just to give you a quick example, dead people generally don't have any data protection rights. The GDPR, which governs data privacy in Europe, for instance, explicitly leaves out deceased individuals. That means that if we would have a situation where a big tech platform that may host hundreds of millions of dead profiles and sometimes an entire lifetime of data on those profiles, Or say it would be like one of these ancestry genealogy sites that holds the DNA of tens of millions of people, many of whom are going to be dead. Let's say one of these companies go bust. What's going to happen to the data? Well, it's going to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. Now, we living users have normally some means of protecting ourselves. But for these potentially hundreds of millions of dead people, they're just going to be auctioned off to whomever is the highest bidder. And that may be Russia, China, you know, any service operating within the same industry, really.
Well, and now you've got companies that have figured out ways to really take these massive quantities of data and use them in ways that perhaps previously there was the question of, why would I want a dead person's data? What value would that provide to my platform? But now they have a use.
Yep. Oh, definitely. And I mean, they have economic usages. You know, there's increasingly becoming a thing of like you can train an AI bot into impersonating someone based on their data. So you can sort of create a digital ghost of someone and then sell that ghost avatar back to the bereaved family, which obviously has some pretty grave moral implications. But there's nothing really stopping you from doing the same biologically. Let's say that I own the data of your deceased parents or grandparents, and I can contact you and be like, oh, look, I have their data. Do you want me to create a clone of your departed father? Or do you not want me to do that? Either way, pay me money. That is like an entirely legal thing to do because there is nothing protecting dead people's data, which is bizarre.
That's terrifying.
It's terrifying. And this is not even mentioning like the political implications of this. Imagine that one of these tech giants went down and data about hundreds of millions, potentially billions of users falls into the hands of morally dubious. I mean, you can argue that they're already in the hands of morally dubious actors, but politically dubious actors. I mean, imagine what a weapon you have. If you have a lifetime of data on the citizens of like every citizen of your enemy country. So we're putting ourselves in huge risk in sort of outsourcing our national and arguably like even civilizational interests to these like handful of tech billionaires. But like I said, like I want to make clear, these are like the obviously bad scenarios. This is the things that I hope that we can like all agree on would be very, very bad. But that in and of itself doesn't solve the larger questions of like which principles ought to guide the governance and curation of our collective digital heritage.
Yeah, these are big questions that, candidly. I spend most of my day thinking about very complicated topics related to data and use and privacy. But this is really kind of a next step up and above. So I have to ask you, because you wrote this wonderful book, The Afterlife of Data, but you wrote it way before this whole AI revolution kicked off. Mm-hmm. And so your book really looks very prescient. And as I understand it now, you have been working on another book, and I would love to hear about it because I haven't read that one. You got to send your friends a preview copy.
I will. It's the first draft of the manuscript is actually just about to be completed. I'm finishing off the last chapter right now. But so the new book is titled Gods of Data, and the subtitle is An Atheist Critique of AI. And it's funny because it sounds like I'm not very creative with my titles. It's something of data. But the idea here, to give you another elevator pitch, is that AI systems have become the gods of the information age, but not necessarily in the way that you would expect. So what's a god? In a theological sense, a god would be a supernatural omnipotent being beyond space and time. I mean,
sitting in the clouds. That's the picture we all have of an omniscient being.
Yeah, that's not AI. It's not omniscient. It's good, but it's not that. Now, in an anthropological sense, a god would be an amalgamation of the authority of the ancestors. So the theory here is that all religion emerges first as a veneration of society itself, of the authority of the ancestors. But with time, the ancestors become too numerous and they collapse into a single identity, a single agency, God. Now, that is exactly how a large language model, for instance, works. It takes society, the digital traces that we leave behind in our everyday activities on the internet, and it collapses these into what is experienced as a singular agency. So what we're interacting with when we interact with these AI chatbots, or at least the large language models ones, is essentially a personification of society's digital past. Now, why am I making this argument? Beyond the fact that it's cool and that it works very elegantly. It's an obvious symmetry.
It does. You connect the dots here very well.
Oh, thanks. I mean, and anyone who studies sociology, even if you've just taken the introduction course, I think we'll have heard of this theory, Durkheim's theory of the elementary forms of religious life, which is this theory that like all religion is essentially the worship of a personified form of society. So it's like one of the foundational theories of sociology, really. But the reason I'm making the argument that I'm establishing this, I call it a structural symmetry between gods and AI systems, is because this move allows me to mobilize one of the richest traditions, if not the richest tradition of Western thought, which is religious critique. So I can use Hegel, Feuerbach, Marx, Hannah Arendt, Nietzsche, Freud, who are all critics of God and the idea of a God, and I transpose their arguments and apply them in the realm of AI instead. And to be clear, like these are atheist thinkers, but they are not atheists in your standard way. They're not saying, oh, God is not real, therefore we should believe in him. Their argument is far more sophisticated. They're saying, if there's a common denominator in this very complex tradition, it would be that it's not the fact that God isn't real. It's the fact that if there would be a perfect being beyond space and time that would sort of solve all of our problems, that wouldn't be desirable. We wouldn't want to live in a world where there would be an external being who could step in and solve all of our problems.
Well, hang on, time out, because okay. you're describing ChatGPT to me right now. It solves all my problems now in a lot of ways.
And that's kind of, that's how I use the, I'm under no illusions that AI actually solves all of our problems. But the point that I'm making in the book is that we increasingly come to use it with that logic, that we outsource our decisions to the past. I call it in the book, I call it a tyranny of the past over the present, and that our quest in this age, which is commonly understood as an age where the machines come to dominate humans, I'm saying, no, it's humans all along. It's just an age where past humans come to dominate the present humans, where our own past becomes personified and sort of externalized into this external being that dominates us. But let me give you just an example of like how that works in practice. So I have this parable in one of my chapters where I say, okay, let's say that you have a young couple who love each other. I call them Alice and Bob. And they have a great passion for one another, but one day they begin fighting. And it turns out that they hold radically different values when it comes to building a family and what's a good life. So they decide to consult an AI couples counselor. And they give it all of their data, their DNA, childhood photos, everything they ever Googled. And the AI crunches the numbers and it spits back the answer to them saying, with 98% certainty, this is going to end in disaster. You should divorce now. In fact, I've already identified replacement partners that statistically fit you much better. And the chances of you regretting this decision is virtually zero. Now, according to standard AI ethics, it's very difficult to articulate a reason why they shouldn't go separate paths. Yet I sense that most of us have this kind of gut feeling that a person living their life in such a way loses something essential in what it is to be human. And I think that this tradition of religious critique, it allows us to articulate what is this quality that is being lost. And in this particular chapter, I argue that ironically, that quality that is lost in such a life would be faith, because faith is always done in spite of something. We take a leap of faith. We're saying, I know that it's vain. I know that the chances of success are virtually zero. I'm going to do it anyway.
And this is the story arc for virtually every great story told in human history, is a human being choosing to do something that defies the odds.
Yeah.
And then winning or dominating in whatever that attempt is, and they become the hero for having bucked the trend and fought against the odds. And we love that as people. So it sounds like part of the argument is that this may be taking away some of our humanity.
Yes, a particular kind of our humanity. So we can call it faith. We can call it, and an important part of faith is courage. Like you say, every good story is about someone courageously doing something. And in the book, and I love this because the book is full of these like biblical references and very, it's very highbrow. But to demonstrate or to illustrate what I mean, I use this episode from the first Harry Potter book when Harry Potter comes to Hogwarts and he puts out the magic sorting hat, which supposedly has some like connection to your inner essence. And the sorting hat goes, oh, I think you would be great in Slytherin. And Harry goes, not Slytherin, not Slytherin. And it says, okay, then it has to be Gryffindor. And towards the end of the book, Harry approaches Dumbledore and he confesses that I don't really belong in Gryffindor. I belong in Slytherin. That's what the hat said. And Dumbledore says, well, it's not our essential qualities, Harry, that define who we are, but our choices. Now, my argument is that the hat wasn't wrong. The hat was right all along. But in defying its verdict, even though it said the best fit is Slytherin and Harry went to Gryffindor instead, then he retroactively, he belonged in Gryffindor all the time. But it wasn't until he made that leap of faith, until he defied the hat, that he actually defined himself, who he was. So if you go back to this couple and you have the magical sorting hat in the shape of modern AI that says, well, here are your chances of success. And they say, we're going to go with it anyway. We're going to take this leap of faith because I have faith and not love. And surely, like a couple that does that, that is ready to sacrifice so much for their love, then after they've made that leap of faith, they're meant to be together. So that's what I'm trying to argue, that we must recognize our human ability to act in the present rather than hide in the safety of the past.
Wow, that is deep.
And to be clear, like the argument is not that, like I want to be really clear, it's not, I'm not saying that like humans are epistemically superior to the machines or like AI is bad at taking these things into account. No, the machine is right. It is 98% certainty that this is going to end in disaster. Still, it's important to defy it.
So let me ask you, I don't often get people who are deep into philosophical discussions on this show. So yeah, I grew up probably somewhat like you. I watched a lot of Star Trek as a kid. My parents were really into it. And, you know, we all saw the Borg, right? This kind of gigantic, cold, universal brain with billions of individuals that had collective thoughts. When you think about these kinds of topics, does it make you ever question whether or not our kind of individualistic approach to humanity and society is the right approach? Meaning, are humans better off where everybody is making their own independent choices and taking leaps of faith, versus that kind of collaborative, collective type of past-driven knowledge? Does that change? Is that better? Is it worse? Is there a good or bad here? Or is it just up to the person?
Mm. So I think that I don't fully agree with the dichotomy. So this leap of faith thing is not necessarily an individualistic act or move. Actually, quite the opposite. When you make the leap of faith, when you say, I'm going to disregard what this personified past is telling me to do, what you're essentially doing is that you're opening yourself up to failure. You're being courageous in that you're daring to step into a relationship of fundamental vulnerability with others. And this is a very a personal experience when I promised my wife to love her my entire life. I mean, I know if I look at the statistics of how many marriages end in divorce, I know that this is a ridiculous thing to say. When I tell my wife that she's the best wife in the world, I mean, out of the 8 billion people on the planet, what are the chances that I happen to be in the same high school class as the person that was the best fit with my personality?
We're going to have to make sure your wife doesn't listen to this episode.
I write this in my book, actually. But when I say it, I mean it with my whole heart. So that's what I mean in saying that it's a very, it's a personal experience, but it's an openness to the other. It's saying we're making this leap of faith together. I'm holding someone's hand as I do it. And it's the same thing. It's the exact same mechanism in politics. So politics is also genuine political discussion is very dangerous because we make this leap of faith in opening ourselves to fundamental uncertainty in that when I speak politically out of my heart, there's always a chance that people are going to reject and ridicule what I'm saying. And that's what politicians today are trying to reduce the risk of failure by outsourcing their communication to AI. They're asking, constantly consulting various models of what should I say? Which phrases to use? Which phrases shouldn't I use? In the book, I write about the 2016 Clinton campaign, which had this huge AI model that they just poured tons and tons of data into. You know, these models are what car do you drive? What kind of pet do you have? Everything that you wouldn't even think would be politically relevant. And then they run simulations. I think the Clinton campaign ran 400 simulations every night. And that spits out where to speak, who to speak to. It basically tailors the entire campaign. And that is the opposite to taking a leap of faith and saying, I don't know if you're going to like this, Here's what I have to say. And I am accepting that you may not like it, that I may lose by saying these things. Worse still, if I'm entering into a genuine political dialogue with someone, I also open myself to the fact that I may come out of this a different person. This may change my view and who I am. And we're increasingly losing this in this AI-dominated landscape where, you're on X and someone writes something upsetting about, say, the Israel-Palestine conflict. And then you're like, okay, how should I respond to this argument? And then you just paste it into ChatGPT and ask it, well, what's the best response to this? And then you just take that and you paste it into the chat. The thing is, the person on the other side may do the exact same thing, maximize their point of view. But what you really have is two people not engaging in any risk whatsoever. They just outsource it to the authority of the personalized past. So that's what I mean by saying that it's not this individualist, collectivists kind of thing. It's rather that we must recognize that we must open ourselves to failure collectively and individually by being open to the other.
And it sounds like one of the real risks here is homogeneity in our society. I mean, we know that these models are using X to train their own corpus of data.
Yeah.
So as you know, I've read many arguments that are concerned more from a business perspective about, if we are then using AI content to train these AI models, you know, does it all kind of revert to the mean, where every single model always has the same opinion about every outcome?
Yep.
That sounds terrifying in a lot of
ways. It is. And I, like, the way I framed this in the book is that, you know, how in the beginning I talked about how the gods are really the authority of the ancestors personified. And right now, the models that we have, at least they're trained on data generated during our lifetime. It's like it's we who have produced the data that goes into the models that then sort of govern our societies. But imagine in a couple of decades, because the models that are trained today are the first generation on the internet. Those are the models that are going to train the next generation of models, both in a literal sense that, you know, you use an LLM to train another LLM, but also in the sense that, like, the corpus that it's trained on will increasingly be written by AI in and of itself. So we who are alive now train models who are going to train models who are going to train models, such that in a couple of generations, it's literally going to be the dead governing the living. When you act with an AI, or interact with an AI in, say, 2090, insofar as they're still going to be data-driven, you're literally going to be interacting with an amalgamation of your ancestors.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine if today all of the answers we got were coming from 1920s prohibition era, right? I mean, the viewpoints about life in the world and how to do things and the right tasks to do things to accomplish the outcomes is all changing so fast. Well, these are really deep questions, and I appreciate you taking through this new book, Gods of Data. So I really hope that when you do get this out into the world, that we can have you back on to talk more in depth about that particular book.
Because I'd love to. And, you know, now we've had a very sort of deep philosophical discussion, but I do want to emphasize that it's a book that I think anyone can pick up this book and find it thoroughly interesting, I hope. Because the application, the areas where I apply this perspective, I think will resonate with most people. There's a chapter on, or resonate with, or at least I think most people can recognize why the stakes are very high. The first chapter is about the AI for parenting industry. Where people increasingly use AI to raise their kids. It's like a huge industry where, you know, your toddler has a tantrum. Throws a tantrum, and you know, you're tired, you haven't eaten. What are you going to do? Well, you just take up your app and you tell the AI what your child did or said, and it will literally provide a script for you of, like, here's how you terminate this tantrum. Here are literally the things to say. When your kid talks back, you just type it into the app, and it gives you another answer for, you know, what is the best way to de-escalate the situation? And then there's a chapter on love, the one that I talked about with a couple. And that's also like an entire industry of these AI couples counselors that give you very statistically detailed answers on your chances of success and so on. And then there's a chapter on AI in law and a final chapter on AI in political communication. These are areas which, as I said, love, parenting, law, politics, these are all areas that are so essential that we open ourselves to the possibility of failure. Otherwise, we're not loving, we're not politically deliberating, and we're not parenting someone else. The results may be better. We may find better jobs, we may be better parents, lovers, politicians, better lives, in short, but it's not our lives.
Yeah, it's at the cost of our own humanity. And it's so funny, I mean, as I hear you talk about, like, the toddler tantrums, I have a toddler. Mm-hmm. All I could think is, what app was that helped them to stop the tantrum? Because, boy, that sure is deductive, right? Quick answers, quick solutions. Well, look, we've talked a lot about philosophical concepts here, but, you know, you've spent a lot of time now thinking deeply about data, about the impacts of these kinds of tools on our society. I'd love to hear your thoughts on policy. You know, how should humanity at large be thinking about policing and governing and making decisions about what we permit and what we do not permit as it relates to these kinds of amazing new technologies? Do you have any viewpoints on that?
I do. And I get this question or versions of this question from journalists whenever I engage with media, which tends to be a lot, actually. And I think that it's an interesting question because there is a hidden assumption underneath it, which is that there is the industry, which is this organic thing that sort of just happens. And then we can place regulation and governance as layers on top of this activity, on top of the commercial activity. And I'd like to think about it the exact other way around. There are no markets without states that provides a space for those markets. And this is historically as well as conceptually true. There's no such thing as a self-governing market. The market is always dependent on the state providing a space for it. And the market always acts in response to the incentives that we set up for it. So rather than focusing on like how can we regulate the industry and regulate the production of technology, I would like to think about it in sort of the opposite way of how can we change the way that we produce things? How can we change the actual activity itself? And I think there are many interesting paths towards that. There are many alternative ways of building technology. I'm thinking of the open source community, for instance, incredible innovation happening there. And I recently came from the International Association of Privacy Professionals, big data protection congress in Brussels. And there, the big discussion was like, well, sort of same here. How do we establish tech sovereignty? All of Europe's technologies are basically owned by external states. So, you know, if the United States wanted to shut Europe down, they could in an instance be just like, oh, like we didn't like that. So I'm sorry, you can't use Microsoft Teams anymore. Like, and all of a sudden, you know, all of Europe just breaks down. And the other keynote speaker whose name I now eludes me, but look her up. She was brilliant. But she made this fantastic point of like, if the Americans would wake up and somebody told them that 80% of your digital infrastructure is owned by the Europeans, do you think that they would respond by, let's add another regulation package that limits what they can do? No. That is not how the Americans would react. They would react in absolute panic, as they should.
And there would probably be some level of military violence involved.
Yeah, exactly. So what she was saying is that the solution can never be antitrust or adding layers of regulation on top. We must build our own things. And I think that goes not only in a national context of like owning our own fundamental infrastructure, but it must go on a democratic level as well. Like, these technologies are the fundamental infrastructures of society. We must have some level of control, not just some kind of like regulatory framework saying, oh, please, could you allow us to walk on our roads? Which is like, you know, kind of what we're doing. We've sold all the roads of society to a handful of corporations. And now we're asking them if we could please, like, can we walk on the roads? It's a bizarre situation to me. That being said, of course, there are important regulations that one could do to get back to the afterlife of data. I think it's a shame that we don't ascribe any data protection rights to deceased individuals. We're opening a huge back door into our own privacy. Like, imagine a future scenario where I may not have any data about you, but let's say that I own your departed family's data, a couple of departed friends. I don't really need your data because I can track you by proxy. especially nowadays when I mean, you said you have a toddler. I'm just guessing that you may share one or two pictures on Instagram.
Oh, yeah, we're terrible about that. We know it's not the right thing to do, yet still we feel the pull to share.
Yeah, and you know, most people are on the internet before they're even born, because the first person that's shared is the ultrasound picture when you're in the womb. So like even before you're born, you have a digital footprint. And that's sort of my point, that the privacy of the dead isn't a niche issue. It's inextricably linked to the privacy of the living. You cannot have one without the other. So of course, being able to regulate that is a kind of short-term, very important thing that we could do. Long-term, we're going to have to look for bigger solutions.
Wow. I'm walking away both inspired and scared at the same time. So let me ask you, I mean, you know, you spend a lot of time thinking about this topic. Does it change your own behavior? Because I know I'm in data privacy, and this is what I spend all day thinking about, is regulatory rights, data privacy, data transfers, these kinds of things. And yet, still, I have a Facebook account, and I do exactly what you just described. I share photos of my children. I talk about where I'm going and what I'm doing so that people who I'm close to can understand what's happening in my life. Do you find yourself conflicted in your own day-to-day life?
Not very. And maybe this is the political scientist in me who speaks, or the sociologist, and that for me, these are sort of collective matters. To me, I'm not so concerned about myself. I'm more concerned about like the society that I'm living in. So I'm more concerned with our data than my data. That being said, I mean, every once in a while, there's a thing that I will do or sacrifice. I mean, when Elon Musk bought Twitter, for instance, I was like, okay, this is really where I draw the line. I think it's unacceptable for me as a privacy advocate and tech ethicist to be on this platform. But often I would encourage people, when it comes to these topics, of not falling for the trap of reducing themselves to a consumer of a platform rather than a citizen of society. Like, as consumers of platforms, we're all helpless. Then if you reduce data privacy to this individual good, then the solutions are going to be clicking a million pop-up notes from the GDPR compliance. I don't know if you used the web in Europe, but it's absolutely terrible.
You know, one of the things we do at Osano is we actually make the world's most prevalent cookie banner. I frequently, when I speak, I have to frequently start off by apologizing to the audience for all of the yes and no buttons they have to click. Yes, that has gotten us there, right? They were trying to solve a societal issue of clear disclosure, and it's clearly kind of gotten out of control.
Yeah. And I think that by in reducing it to this kind of like individual good, I think it's going to cause a backlash. I think it's actually going to have the opposite effect. You see this already with people hating upon the GDPR. You know, my wife works at a school, and she's like, it's terrible. Like, we can't do anything really because of GDPR compliance. And if you have a parent who comes in and they're like, give me every email that contains my child's name, they have to take out three teachers who are going to sit an entire day and just search through documents and look through papers with that child's name on it. And it's like, this is not what it's for. So ironically, they created these big regulatory frameworks to bust big tech. But the irony is that big tech is the only kind of organizations that have the organizational know-how and infrastructure to actually comply, whereas everybody else is scrambling. They don't know what they're doing. And sadly, a lot of organizations, what people choose to do is to just delete data because they're so afraid of GDPR compliance. And And that's what you get when you reduce it to this kind of individual good.
Yeah, which was which results in haves and have-nots in technology, right?
Yeah.
Now the Googles, the Amazons of the world can absolutely afford to keep all of our data because they can build that regulatory compliance response. But the school, the small business, they're up a creek because they have to choose, do I want to spend a lot of money and time on this or do I just want to make do without?
It's the same with AI. I mean, that's why you see OpenAI, a couple of months after they launched ChatGPT, came out and they're like, oh, these technologies are so dangerous that there should be a license. Like only we and our friends should be allowed to do this, which is like such a bullshit way of just saying, we don't want any like open source people doing this for free. Like we want to make money because they know that like they have a plausible case to more or less get a monopoly. And that's why I think the tech sector, they're at least not totally against regulation because they know that regulation will lock out a lot of competition.
This is true. Look, Carl, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time today to join us and share your views and thoughts. I, for one, am deeply looking forward to Gods of Data and an atheist critique of AI. And for everybody in the audience, thank you. I can't wait to read it. And for everybody in our audience, you can go pick up a copy of The Afterlife of Data. And that one is a couple of years out, but very, very relevant to our present tense situation. So please go online and search for Dr. Carl Ullman, Afterlife of Data. You will absolutely find it to be a riveting read that will leave you breathless and asking a lot of deep questions like we've done on this show. So Carl, thank you for joining.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Privacy Insider Podcast. You can find a full transcript of this episode and any show notes at osano.com. That's www.osano.com. And while you're there, get access to an excerpt of my book, The Privacy Insider, How to Embrace Data Privacy and Join the Next Wave of Trusted Brands, which is now available on Amazon for purchase. Until next month, take care. And remember, data privacy is a fundamental human right, y'all.